So with all these verses that we're going through now, you know, where it seems like Dharma Rakshita is hacking away at, you know, the things we cling to and exposing all of our faults publicly, can you imagine? And pointing out all of our faults to us directly, you know, right in front of our face. All these things that are being pointed out to us are, we engage in under the influence of our own self-centered thought. So I think it's important to remember that, you know, he's exposing all of our faults, not just to pick up at us, not to make us defensive and miserable, but so that we can see them and so that we can become convinced in the defects of the self-centered thought and thereby, you know, work to eliminate it from our mind stream. So it's good with all these, this whole section of verses that we're working on now, you know, when we start to see these behaviors in ourselves, to continue to remind ourselves, this is the fault of the self-centered thought. Yeah. This is the fault of my self-preoccupation. And in that way, we get stronger energy to oppose it rather than to follow it. And as we do, we're not as deceived by its deceit towards us. Okay. So I think we were on... We had just finished verse 69, right? Talking about how the three jewels are our real refuge, but then we propitiate spirits and so on. Now the question came up, well, what about, you know, the nature oracle and the different oracles that the Tibetans use? Isn't that, you know, some of the same stuff about channeling and oracles and mediums and seeking protection from spirits and so on? Isn't that exactly what Dharma Rakshita was talking about? I think the case of Nechung is something unique in the sense that there's a long history here. And that is that when Buddhism first came to Tibet, there were a lot of hindrances from spirits. And, well, first, before we start that, you know, Tibet and many cultures are the kind of cultures where people believe in, a lot in spirits and in external beings. And our culture, you know, or we as individuals may not believe in it so much, although certainly in Western culture there's a long history of it. You know, and people doing exorcism and the Salem witch trials and all this whole thing. So it's not totally alien from our culture, even though now with the advent of science, you know, we don't hold on to those ideas so much. So I think the question comes, you know, well, do these beings actually exist or not exist? And it's hard to say. Yeah. And there are some situations... I'm just speaking personally here, so, you know, because I didn't grow up believing in these beings. There are some situations in which I've had a sense that, oh, you know, there could be some kind of unseen being who's causing a little bit of disturbance here. But then it seems to me also that many times what people do is they, rather than look inside, they say, oh, it's the fault of some spirit, you know, and so it's just another way of projecting outwards what our own stuff is. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that it doesn't really matter in a specific situation whether it's an external being or whether it's our own internal demons. You know, I mean, because for sure there are our own internal demons, our self-centeredness and our self-grasping. And without those, no external demon or no external human being for that matter or animal can harm us. You know, in other words, it's because we've created the karma through our own ignorance and self-centeredness that anybody can harm us. If we didn't have the internal ghost, you know, the external ones couldn't disturb us at all. But in looking at situations in terms of working with people, my own personal conclusion is that it doesn't necessarily matter in a given situation if there is an actual real external being or not who's causing damage. What matters most is the cultural paradigm that that person is working with. Okay? In the sense that, I'll give you a couple of examples. One of my friends some years ago was doing her doctoral research in Dharamsala, and she was interviewing Tibetans, and she had a young Tibetan woman who had gone to TCV, Tibetan Children's Village, for her education, and this young woman was translating for my friend. And at a certain point, and this young woman wanted to marry one of her classmates from TCV, but her parents were very opposed to it. They wanted her to marry somebody else. So there was conflict and tension and so on in the family. And at one point, the young woman had what in the West we would call a nervous breakdown. You know, she just like fell apart because of all this pressure. Well, in Tibetan society, they don't know the word nervous breakdown. There's no diagnosis for nervous breakdown. It doesn't exist, you know. Because there's no label, there's no concept of it. Mm-hmm. So when they look at things like that, and what did the family do? Is they took her to, they kind of have sometimes village lamas who do different pujas, or sometimes, you know, a regular monk, and they ask for pujas to be done to help her to dispel this interference from a ghost that was causing her to be mentally unstable. And that was the way they dealt with the difficulty. And they went to the lama, and he did puja. And in the course of doing the puja and talking with the family, he said, you know, this she's having this spirit harm because of this conflict, and you know, you should really let her marry who she wants to marry, because then the spirit harm will go away. So then when the family heard that, then they said, okay, you know, you can marry this boy. And, you know, and then, of course, she got well. Yeah. Now, it's hard to say, was it the pujas, you know? Was there an external spirit harm, and was there pujas, and did that happen, and did her parents changing the mind, you know, make a spirit harm start, or did her parents changing their mind stop her internal feeling of pressure, and so she recovered? We don't know, do we? You know, unless we have clairvoyant powers, no way to know. But the thing was, whatever the lama did, it worked. Yeah, and he was dealing within their cultural paradigm, you know. Because if you had said to the parents, well, your daughter had a nervous breakdown, let's take her to the hospital and stuff her full of drugs, it's highly unlikely, you know, we don't know if she would have recovered or not. Okay? So, and then I was reading one other anthropological story, something written by an anthropologist in Malaysia, where some of the position of women in that culture was such that they couldn't always express their emotions. And so, especially by the time they got to be around middle age, many of them started having what was diagnosed in Malaysian culture as spirit interference. Okay? And what this anthropologist was saying was, when they had spirit interference, you know, because it was it was seen as an external being causing them difficulties, then they could all of a sudden express all of their emotions that it wasn't culturally acceptable to express if you're okay. But when you have a spirit interference, the culture accepts that you say all these things and express yourself. So this anthropologist, you know, her feeling was that this was a paradigm used to enable these women to express what couldn't be expressed in a socially acceptable way. Okay. Now, whether there were real spirits or not, we have no way of knowing, or whether it was just a psychological issue, who knows? But somehow, after they expressed themselves, and then people, the whole group, the village, did prayers for them, they often got better. Okay? So, what I'm getting at is, I'm just sharing my personal conclusion, is that I don't think we need to stress too much about are these things real or not, but see that there's different ways of describing the same event in different cultures. And when you're dealing with a person who grew up in a certain culture, it's good to use the way that they're familiar with to describe something, because you have a much better, stronger likelihood of helping them if you do. Okay? So back to the situation of nature, okay? And here again, you know, in dealing with Tibetan culture where there's, you know, in their worldview, there's all these other living beings, you know, it's not just human beings and animals, but there's all these spirits and gods and, you know, universes full of other beings. The Tibetans take that very seriously, and they feel like they live in this world where they're not just dependent on humans and so on, but, you know, on all these other living beings. And, I mean, in a way, it's kind of like with the advent of modern technology, we feel much more related to all the people in the world, whereas, you know, centuries ago, probably people didn't. Well, in the same way, the Tibetans feel interrelated with all these other beings that they share their space with. You know, even though they didn't have modern technology to think about people across the world, it was that same, you know, feeling of interrelationship. In any case, when Buddhism came to Tibet, there was resistance, as the story goes, from the part of certain spirits. So when they were building Samye Monastery, the first monastery in Tibet, they would work very hard to build it, and then the spirits would come and tear it down during the day. During the night, and then they have to build it again during the next day, and then it will get torn down during the next night. So, you know, in modern terms, it could be you build it, and then the building inspector comes and doesn't approve of what you've done and makes you tear it down, and you have to build it again, and then you have another hassle with another government department or something like this. Anyway, you know, it's a situation of having a lot of hassles, and you're trying to do something virtuous. So, the Tibetans called Padmasambhava, who's also known as Guru Rinpoche, who was a great Indian yogi, to come to Tibet and help with the situation. So Guru Rinpoche came, and he threw stones at these spirits, you know, and when you go to Samye, there's all these little kind of special kind of stones on the ground, and I was given some when I was there, and some are, you know, in the statue. But so he subdued the spirits, and he not only just subdued them, but he made them promise to protect the Dharma. So, and I find that this is really interesting because, you know, in this whole thing of subduing evil forces, you don't just subdue it and squish them and, you know, put them in prison and without due process and they sit and rot until they die, okay? But they were converted so that they became Buddhist, and they had to take pledges to protect Buddhist practitioners. Okay? So specifically, there's a group of five spirits or deities, you know, that are commonly known as Nechum. And when Guru Rinpoche subdued them, you know, he made them promise to really support the Dharma in Tibet and protect practitioners. And then as time went on, Nechung became like a protector of the Tibetan government and of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Once, many centuries later, the Dalai Lamas became the heads of the Tibetan government. Okay, so there's this century-old tradition of Nechung, you know, helping the Dalai Lama. So, you know, when His Holiness in 1959 was in Norbalinga, and there was all the Tibetan crowds were outside to protect him because the Chinese wanted him to come to an opera performance, but the Tibetans were afraid that they would kill him. And there was so much tension, and he didn't know what to do. He summoned Nei Chung, and Nei Chung goes into trance, and then he told His Holiness, you know, leave. And so that's when His Holiness dressed up, and they snuck him out of the Norbalinga, and he fled into India. So the Tibetan government and some of the monasteries still consult Nei Chung now on important kind of worldly issues, but Nei Chung doesn't give Dharma teachings, he gives practical advice. So their refuge is not in, a path of teachings that are taught, but in that practical advice. And because, you know, there's this full history in their culture of Nei Chung having been subdued and promised to help them and having helped the Dalai Lama through many centuries, then, you know, they pay attention to that. That doesn't mean that we as Westerners need to get all involved with this and enthralled with it. Yeah. Like I said, Nei Chung is a specific case because, you know, it's like His Holiness and Nei Chung have a personal relationship. But then there's lots of other people who may, you know, be doing channeling. Or they might have psychological problems. You don't really know because different societies will talk about it in different ways. But again, if people go to these beings who have a little bit of clairvoyance and then start following some spiritual path of their teaching or pay more attention to the practical advice those spirits give instead of really practicing the Dharma and following karma, that's when the refuge starts to degenerate. Okay? When people become kind of more excited about, oh, let's go to the spirit and see what the spirit has to say about my life, you know, and get the personal advice, rather than trust the triple gem and trust, karma and refuge, you know, and really see that, you know, if we haven't created the karma, it doesn't matter how many fortune tellers and mediums you go to, they can't prevent any suffering. Okay. So does this answer the question that came up? Okay. And just to follow a little bit along with that, like I said, you know, you don't really know about kind of what the actual cause of something is. And sometimes you meet people with very severe mental problems and, you know, you might get a sense, oh, there's some kind of spirit interference here. But then other people, you get a sense that, no, it's a chemical, biological thing and they, you know, they just need some meds and it's okay. So it's, you know, there could be multiple causes for something within one person, or even within different people, their problems could be caused by different things. But the one thing that is shared in common, of whether it's a spirit interference or a biological, chemical thing or psychological thing, one thing that all these situations all share in common is that it wouldn't happen if we hadn't had created the cause through our own self-centeredness. Okay, because all these things are definitely related to our karma. So no matter what the condition is that brings them about in this life, if we hadn't created negative karma in previous lives, the difficulty would not be happening. So that's why it always comes back to working them with the mind, purifying the mind, purifying karma. Okay? Then, verse 70. Though always living in solitude, I am swept away by distraction. Though receiving scriptures of holy dharma, I nurture divination and shamanism. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so this is talking about people who have the possibility to practice the dharma, but get distracted by doing other things. So in particular, you know, though always living in solitude, I am swept away by distraction. So solitude here can mean somebody living in a retreat situation, or it could mean somebody living in a monastery, you know, in a place that's relatively solitary that should be ideal for practice. Okay, there's not too much hustle and bustle there. But what happens? We're swept away by distraction. So our mind invents all these things to get distracted by, you know. and I've got to do this, and I've got to do that, and I've got to, you know, plant this, and I've got to plant that, and I've got to grow this, and I've got to do this errand and that errand and clean this and build that and da 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 da. You know, just kind of running around, keeping ourselves, as Geshe Darge used to say, the busiest of the busy. Okay, so it could mean that we're physically busy doing everything, all in the name of creating the perfect situation so that later we can meditate. Because we find this happening, you know. It's like, I'm very busy and I'm going to get the whole environment, you know, make my retreat cabin the most beautiful one. Actually, I knew somebody who did this, spent years building her retreat cabin, gorgeous thing, always improving it, and this and that and the other thing. And then started, you know, then they started having visa difficulties, and she took it upon herself to solve everybody's visa difficulties and wound up leaving her retreat. You know, because her mind got distracted. So, you know, those kinds of things, and you know, just keeping ourselves distracted by having to do things. So it could be, you know, somebody who says, okay, I'm going to do retreat, but then you always see them in town because they forgot something, or they're always on the phone because they forgot to tell somebody something, or they're always on email during the retreat, or, you know, something's always coming up that distracts their retreat so they can't fully focus. And in their minds, they think, oh, this is incredibly important. I've got to do this. Yeah, but it's very distracting. And so that's the reason why we often do group retreats where there's a shared discipline that everybody follows, because then you have the support of the group. You know, because if you start getting on the phone or doing email or going into town, everybody else is going to say, hey, what are you doing? We're all doing this retreat together. You can't do that. We all promised to be here and support each other. And then it pulls you back in. You know, and in fact, you don't think of doing it so much to start with, because you know that your friends are going to say something if you do it. Yeah, so group retreats often, you know, help people quite a bit. Okay, so why do we get swept away from distraction when we have a very good opportunity to practice? Self-centered mind, isn't it? You know, I've always got to do this, I've always got to do that. And after I complete all these things, then I'll have the perfect situation to practice. And of course, it never gets done. So that's why, you know, I think, like, we're certainly busy here at the Abbey, but I think that's why it's really important that we have scheduled times of meditation that we don't skip. We have teachings, even though our schedule has to be flexible sometimes. And that we really make an effort to remember our motivation in the morning and to do some review in the evening, so that what we're doing, although we're very busy, becomes part of our practice. Yeah, and that we watch our mind as we're operating with each other and watch what's coming up, and we can really learn about a lot about ourselves in that way. And then we take what we see about ourselves into our meditation in that very day, you know, because maybe you're working with somebody and, you know, you want to do things one way and they want to do things another way, and, you know, and then just watching how our mind gets irritated. And then, you know, in the evening, just kind of sitting and like, okay, well, why was I getting so irritated? And, you know, how can I let that go? And, you know, working with our mind in a very practical way like that. And then when we do, we really see our behavior start to transform. Yeah. And it takes a while because some of our habits are pretty ingrained, but, you know, when you're in a community where everybody's trying to work on themselves in that way, then, you know, you kind of keep, you know that the group knows that you're trying to work on it. Yeah? And you kind of count on other people's tolerance, but you also kind of count on them sometimes going, could you work a little bit harder? You know, you work on that defilement a little bit harder, and then you kind of count on them being able to say to them, you know, I have a problem with this. Could you sometimes just humor me a little bit and, you know, yeah, don't push so quite so hard, because I am trying. So, you know, it's kind of the community life is designed with those kinds of, you know, mechanisms built in when we're all kind of trying and we all become, you know, because when you live in community, everybody knows your stuff, so you just stop trying to hide it, you know. And then you begin to laugh at it and point it out when you're doing it, and, you know. Because if you point it out first, then others can't point it out. But, you know, we just kind of realize we're all kind of in it together and, you know, helping each other. Okay. When the second line says, though receiving scriptures of holy dharma, I nurture divination and shamanism. Okay? So though we hear, you know, teachings that have a direct lineage from the Buddha that really talk about, you know, how to keep ethical discipline, how to meditate, how to develop bodhicitta, how to develop the realization of emptiness. You know, though we hear all these kinds of teachings, you know, and those are the things explaining the actual path of what to practice, what do we do instead? And remember, this is in the context of an Asian culture, divination and shamanism. Okay? So, why is that? Well, when you do divinations, like most, I mean, the Tibetans have many different kinds of divination. One of the most popular ones is Mohs, and Mohs are when you have dice and you throw the dice, and then according to the number reading on the dice you and the kind of question and issue it is, you can look up in a text and get some advice. So, you know, people might spend time doing that or different shamanistic practices, you know, doing horoscopes and you know, just visiting families to do puja to dispel spirit interferences. And while some of those pujas are definitely Buddhist pujas, in the person's mind, maybe they're just doing these things to earn a living. You know, because when you stay in the monastery and study, you may not get as many offerings as if you go to people's house and do puja, because people like when you do puja for them, and, you know, and then they'll make big offerings. And you see this in America, too, you know? I mean, when some of the Tibetans come through, if people will, you know, invite them to their houses, and they'll do a puja, and the benefactors will offer quite a bit. But to the monks who are, and nuns who are actually in the monastery studying, they won't offer so much, you know? And that's kind of the opposite to the way it should be, yeah? But, you know, this is the way the world is, and, you know, and why is it? Because we're always interested in things that directly benefit us right now in this life. Yeah? So that's what, you know, it's hitting at here, how we talk about dharma and future lives and liberation and enlightenment, but we often live according to, well, what is going to benefit my life right now in the greatest way? You know? And that view of things is skewed. That's not a real dharma view. Now, you know, here where it says the receiving scriptures of holy dharma, I nurture divination and shamanism, you know, what we might say in a Western context is though receiving scriptures of holy dharma, I nurture New Age philosophies and crystals and, you know, astrology and, you know, all tarot cards and, you know, having your third eye opened. And all these kinds of things, okay? So, you know, in a Western context, you know, we just have other things that are spiritual in some way, you know, or alternative. And although we're hearing the teachings of the Holy Dharma, where, you know, that really teach us the path to enlightenment, you know, we just get distracted by all these other things, looking for some instant benefit, something that's going to help us right now. You know, because actually practicing and looking at our own mind and changing it is much more arduous work than it is, you know, going to a psychic or having your tarot cards read or something like this. So I'm not saying that none of those things have any value, you know. Maybe they do. I don't know very much about them. I don't go to them at all. But in any case, you know, the real thing that's going to help us is the Dharma. Or we could also say, one other thing, the receiving scriptures of Holy Dharma, I nurture my own story and all my psychological problems and going to the therapist who's going to listen to me all the time, you know. So I'm not knocking therapy, but I'm saying that sometimes people confuse therapy with spiritual practice. Okay? And therapy is useful in its own realm, and for what it does, but when people are doing a spiritual practice, if they get confused and they think, oh, if I just went to a therapist and, you know, and kind of worked out all my issues, then, you know, I would be a spiritual person. That's not exactly it, okay? You know, it's like, I think therapy is principally designed to benefit people in this life. I mean, it's part of our culture, and our culture views things as just happening in this life. And so I think therapy is useful and valid in that context. But what we often do is we confuse therapy with spirituality. Okay? So that's what I'm hitting at here, is when we should be doing, or we're saying we want to do a spiritual practice, but we neglect our spiritual practice and mistakenly think that therapy is going to lead us to enlightenment. Okay? Whereas I haven't met many therapists who claim to be able to lead you to enlightenment. You know, there's no false pretense on the part of therapists. They're very clear. They're not pretending to do that, but we get confused. Okay? So I think it's valid and useful to go to a therapist when you need a therapist, you know, and when that benefits you. It's quite useful. But don't confuse it with spiritual practice. And similarly, don't confuse spiritual practice with therapy and think that, you know, all you need to do is meditate and some of those issues will go away. Your meditation can help quite a bit, you know. But some people may get stuck and find it useful to talk to a therapist. Not everybody will. Some people may not. You know, so I think it has to be open so that everybody does what's most suitable for them. Is that making some sense? Okay. So I'm basically, what is basically getting talked about here is how we get distracted from our spiritual practice looking for something that is going to bring us more peace of mind or more happiness in this life. So it's the mind that's not looking beyond this life. And it's the mind actually that looks beyond the happiness of this life that is the mind that starts Dharma practice. You know? That's the discriminating line. Okay, so dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception, mortally struck at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay? So why do we have all this distraction? You know, why do we ignore the Dharma and pursue other things? Because of the self-centeredness and the ignorance. So dance and trample on their head, or roar and thunder on their head, whichever, you know, way of translating brings the best image to your mind. But don't give the self-centeredness space to run around. Okay, then verse 71, forsaking ethical discipline, the path to liberation, I cling to my household. Throwing my happiness into a river, I chase after misery. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception, mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so forsaking ethical discipline, the path to liberation, I cling to my household. Okay, so in the context of a layperson's practice, what that line would mean is that, you know, instead of taking the five lay precepts, you cling to all your attachments of your household and deceiving others to get what's better for your family, cheating others, you know, a form of stealing to get what's good for your family, creating lots of harsh words and negative speech karma, to make your reputation good or to, you know, protect your family. So forsaking ethical discipline, holding on to one's own family and household in a way that makes you create a lot of negative karma. Okay? So that, you know, like getting distracted, going out and drinking with friends and stuff like that. Okay? So that's what this line would mean in the context of a layperson's practice. In the context of a monastic who's practicing, what it means is somebody who has had the fortune to take monastic vows, then, you know, disrobes and goes back to have a family and a household, thus tossing away the ethical discipline and, opportunity to create so much good karma that monastic life had afforded them. Okay, so why does that happen? Self-centered thought and ignorance. Yeah, and usually it's desire. Yeah, usually it's the precept that most commonly makes people disrobe is the one about sexual contact and celibacy. You know, very few people say, I want to disrobe because I want to go murder someone. You know, I haven't heard anybody say that. Yeah? But it's usually the one about sex, you know, and intimate relationships. That's the hard one. And so, you know, cherishing the family life, the household life, wanting comfort, you know, not just sex, not just emotional intimacy, but one's own place, more material possessions, you know, because a monastic life is a simpler life. It's more stripped down. You don't have so much stuff. And then, you know, you kind of want stuff, you know. You want to be able to go on a vacation, want to be able to have a boat, or want to, you know, go golfing, or whatever it is, okay? So somebody who throws away the opportunity to attain liberation that a monastic life affords in the sense that, well, let me finish this, who throws that away in order to have entertainment and pleasure in this life, okay? So they discard the path to liberation. So what is valuable about the monastic life is that when you have precepts, every moment you are not breaking them, you are accumulating good karma. Okay? And this applies also for the lay precepts. You know, your five lay precepts, the same thing applies. It's just that monastics have more precepts, so it's more good karma. Because the idea is that when you take a precept, you are making an intention of how you're going to act, and you are acting that way. So that's creating karma. You have the mental action, your intention, and then physically and verbally you are doing that by not counteracting your precept. So every moment you're not doing that, even you're asleep, you're creating good karma. Yeah. So if you don't have the precept, you might still not be doing those things, but because you don't have the intention not to do them, and because you don't have your speech and body following along with that, there's no accumulation of good karma. So there might be two people sitting in this room. One of them has the precept to abandon killing. One doesn't. Okay, nobody's killing in this room right now. Yeah, but the person who doesn't have the precept, there's no special intention that they, you know, are not going to kill. They're just not killing. Whereas the person who does have the precept, then they have that intention and they're acting that way. And so they're accumulating the good karma of not killing. And they're purifying the previous karma of killing that they've created. Okay? So you see the value in having precepts. And, you know, the monastic life has many more precepts, so you create more good karma and purify more strongly. And also, the monastic life cuts out a lot of the distractions that we have. Okay? So when somebody disrobes, because they want, you know, family and friends and pleasure and an easier, more comfortable life, it's said that they are throwing their happiness into a river. They chase after misery. Okay, so the second line. So they have the opportunity for happiness by keeping precepts and having the external circumstances for good Dharma practice, but they throw that in the river and chase after misery. Okay, so why, from a monastic viewpoint, is a lay life one of misery? You know? Because it is. So, because, you know, people get married with the idea that there's going to be happiness. And how many people do you see who are happily married? Yeah? I mean, just even look at your parents' marriage or marriages. You know, I mean, how many of you come from families where your parents are divorced, you know? How many family lives are really happy? And yet we chase after, you know, having a partner, thinking that that person's going to give us everlasting happiness. But when we look around, how many people are everlastingly happy with their partner? And even if those few people who do have a good relationship, inevitably somebody dies. You can't stay together forever. So then you have the grief of separation at the time of death. Yeah. And then people think that children are going to bring them happiness. Well, when they're first born, you know, you're totally sleep deprived because you have to get up in the middle of the night and feed them. Then when they're toddlers, you know, they're just always saying, I want this, I want that, you know. Then when they go to school, it's like even more so. They want more things because they want to be like their friends. And then when they hit preteens or teenage, you know, they go ballistic. And, you know, they don't talk to you. They accuse you of all sorts of things. You know, you have this child and you nurtured them, and then as they grow up, they kind of, you know, I mean, think of the ways we treated our parents. And we're kind of nice people, aren't we? Yeah. But think of how, as teenagers, we treated our parents. Yeah. So, yeah. Have we ever apologized to our parents? Sometimes I think it's useful to, you know, to go and apologize to them. You know, but you think that that whole lifestyle is going to make you happy, but then when you look, it's, you know, it's fraught with different misery. And, you know, you have kids and then you're always worried about them, you know, because you want them to be best, but it's your version of best and they don't want to be best in that way. They want to do something else. Yeah, because they find something else brings them happiness, not your version of that. You know, and then they have all sorts of different problems, and you're constantly worried about them, and you feel like you need to be able to control their whole lives and make them always safe, and as a parent you can't, you know? How can you always protect your child? You can't, and so that brings a lot of suffering as a parent. No? And then you have to work so hard to get money and then, you know, constantly in debt and credit card debt and mortgages and, you know, it's hard to say no to your kids, you know, because they want things. And it's hard to say no to yourself because you feel you need to be like everybody else on the block or everybody else at work, you know. And then there's all the social pressure to go to parties and family obligations and, you know, so much stuff that you have to take care of. And especially worrying about money and you know, and then people call that happiness. Okay. So this is, you know, from a monastic viewpoint, this is how you look at lay life. And I think there's a degree of truth in that. I mean, that was my experience anyway. Okay. So the teaching's happening in a monastery on planting some seeds here. But, you know, to just think about it, because, you know, and look around and who is happy. I remember Ashen Amaro, he's a Theravada monk, when, you know, before he met the Dharma, he was, you know, he'd gone to Thailand, everybody when they go to Thailand, not everybody, but many people when they go to Thailand, you know, lying on the beaches and food and music and, you know, just living it up, the good life. I hear a lot of stories about the Thai beaches. Anyway, So he was, you know, one of those people who's lying around on the Thai beaches, you know, doing whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted to do it. And, you know, no rules, no precepts, zip, you know, just follow your mind, whatever your impulsive mind wants. And then at one point he decided to go to, you know, one of Ajahn Chah's monasteries, and he went there. And here were these monks, and they had, you know, 227, you know, rules and precepts and things that, you know, and they couldn't do this, and they couldn't do that, and they couldn't do the other thing. And at first he was going, oh, there's so many rules, and they can't do this and that and the other thing. And then he said after a week he started looking around, and, well, but they're a lot happier than I am, and I can do anything I want to do. And he said it really made him think, you know, that being able to do anything our berserky mind wants to do isn't really happiness. That voluntarily taking on some restraints, you know, so that we, you know, because what precepts are it's a determination not to do what we don't want to do anyway, but we see our mind can get carried away doing. You know, and so he really saw that those people were liberated from doing things that create confusion in their life because of having the precepts. You know, and so they found themselves, you know, that he said it really made him think that, you know, the monastics were a lot happier than he was. You know, and if you look at somebody like the Dalai Lama, that's certainly true, isn't it? Yeah. So. Okay, so this verse also is commenting about, you know, sometimes there's situations where people are ordained, but they live like a lay person and act like a lay person, and it's by their own choice that they're doing that. Okay, so the situation of some Western monastics, you know, like we've been talking, is they don't have a place to live, they don't have money, they have to go to work, they have to pay rent, and it's a kind of a pretty, often a very difficult and miserable life for them doing that. But then you have people, especially in the Asian community, where they have monasteries, and they have a situation to practice, but their own mind is distracted, and they'd much rather go in the city and have their own apartment and do some business or do this and that. And it's actually in violation of the precepts, but, you know, the culture has become tolerant of them doing that, and so they do it. And so this verse is saying that people who do that, who have the vows, but they're not really keeping them well and not really practicing well, and instead, you know, living on their own in the city, doing whatever, you know, their mind wants, far away from their teacher, far away from the Sangha community, that they're, you know, giving up their opportunity to advance on the spiritual path because they're following their mind of distraction. Yeah. And unfortunately, I see this more and more, like when I go to India now. I see this in my own home community of Tibetan practitioners, you know, of sometimes the young monks, they would much rather come to America to go to school than stay in India. And so they usually meet some, you know, Western woman who is sympathetic to them. Sometimes it's a middle-aged woman who treats him like the son. Sometimes it's a younger woman who they become lovers with, who then will sponsor them to come to the West, you know, and both minds are quite confused about the whole thing, you know, because the woman thinks, well, I'm helping this monk, but actually there's some attachment in there, and the monk thinks, you know, oh, I'm going to the West, and, you know, who knows what in the world is going on in his mind. I think many have the plan to disrobe before they even leave India. And some of them don't get that notion until they get here, but there were definitely seeds when they still were in India. And then they come over here, you know, ostensibly to go to school, but then, you know, they're out of their community, they don't have any support, there's sense, pleasure, delight in America, and they disrobe. Yeah. And so now when I meet Americans who, you know, are talking about bringing monks and nuns to the West, and sometimes they'll write to me and consult me for advice how to do that, and sometimes it's even in the name of helping the monastery, I write back or I talk to them and I say, be very careful, because the experience is that a lot of these people who come over, even with the motivation to help the monastery, the young ones wind up disrobing. And the ones who come over just independently, you know, they aren't coming with the idea of helping the monastery, they're coming independently. Most of them wind up disrobing. So please really check if this is going to be something beneficial. And, you know, check the stability of the person in question, if they're really a good practitioner who can handle living in the West with all the sense pleasure here and the way our society operates. You know, because, you know, the Tibetan monks, for example, they aren't used to being around women so much. Or they're used to being around women, but Tibetan society has very clear strictures and you don't go around hugging people. Well, you come to America, everybody hugs everybody, and the lay people don't know that you're not supposed to hug a monastic of the opposite sex. And so they go and throw their arms around, you know, a woman goes and hugs a monk, or a man comes and hugs a nun, and, you know, and then, the monastic's mind goes, oh, well, you know, I should do something to fit in with these people, and then they wind up hugging back, and then, you know, you go from there. So, you know, it's very, very important to be really careful, you know, and really check if what we're doing is helping or not. Mm. Yeah. Because I think that, you know, to help people maintain their ordination, you know, is much more important. But then, you know, there are people who ordain. In, you know, Tibetans who were put in the monastery when they were children, they didn't choose that life. And so when they get to be older, then when they have the possibility of choosing, then they leave the monastery. So, you know, you can understand how that can happen, you know, because it wasn't a choice they made. You know, if they have the possibility to live as a monastic their whole life, that's better. But you can also understand how somebody would disrobe if it wasn't their choice to become a monastic to start with. Mm-hmm. You know. So then people say, well, how come they ordain people when they're so young? Well, when you're young, then you have that, you know, your memory's very good and you're very fresh, and so it's possible to memorize a lot of the scriptures. You get that whole influence of growing up, you know, with people who are keeping ethical discipline. You start practicing Dharma very early. So it's a good environment for a child. On the other hand, you know, those kids when they hit teenage and early 20s, then they haven't had the experiences that we've had, and they want those experiences, and so their mind often, you know, when it's possible to get them, then they seek them. Whereas those of us who have grown up with them in America with, you know, everything, then when we become adults, we go, well, you know, I've had the American dream, I've been there, done that, got the t-shirt. What's next? You know, that doesn't bring any happiness. And so I think that many of the Westerners who are ordained, you know, have a better understanding sometimes of the nature of suffering, of change, you know, the suffering of change, because they've had everything. But then on the other hand, you know, 20 years of our life has been spent in all of that, and, you know, we're older, so it's harder to learn, and it's hard, we have habits formed, so it's harder to alter our habits. Yeah. So there's advantages and disadvantages of both ways. Yeah. And, you know, factoring in modern society now, it becomes even more difficult because, you know, the monastics have to be able to function in modern society, but does that mean you give every child a secular education and then they don't learn the Dharma well when they're young, and you're depriving them of that? Because, you know, if you can learn the Dharma when you're 6 and 7 years old and, you know, learn about things and develop good ethical habits and things when you're a kid, boy, that really serves you for your whole life. More than learning, you know, what we learned. And yeah. You know, the history of the American colonists, or, you know, whatever it was that, you know, we learned. So it's hard to, you know, to say what is the best. Maybe there's not the best. Maybe we just live in a complicated world and we're all doing the best we can according to our own culture. Okay, let's do the next verse. Forsaking, verse 72, forsaking the gateway to liberation, I wander in wilderness. Though obtaining the precious human life, I seek the hell realms. Dance and trample on the head of this betrayer, false conception. Mortally strike at the heart of this butcher, the enemy, the self. Okay, so forsaking the gateway to liberation, I wander in wilderness. Wilderness doesn't mean, you know, you go backpacking out in this, you know, the Rockies. Wilderness means places where you can't find the Dharma. Okay, where there's no Dharma teachings or Dharma books or supportive community. So, you know, you have the opportunity to practice the Dharma, but forsaking the gateway to liberation, we go into the city. You know, we get a job, we go here, we go there, we go traveling, we go on business trips, we go, you know, for pleasure trips. We're just, you know, going everywhere looking for happiness. That's called wandering in the wilderness, okay? But you could be wandering in the city, and the city's the wilderness, okay? So just looking for happiness, you know, worldly happiness. And giving up our Dharma study and our Dharma practice to do that. So this pertains, you know, in some way to the situation I was just talking about the Tibetan monks who come to the West, you know, who are, you know, wanting some pleasure, wanting to learn more or to do some business so that they have money to send back to their family. You know, and initially, you know, it seems like a good reason, and somebody might want to help somebody come to the West because the monk comes and says, I have family in Tibet and they're really poor and I want to make some money and send them some money, or my family's in India and they're really poor and if I come to the West, you know, it's helping other sentient beings, I'll get a job and make some money and send it to my family. And it sounds like a very good reason. But from the view of somebody who's taken monastic vows, that's not what they should be doing, because when you take monastic vows, you give up the household life, you know, and you've made the determination not to get involved in all those kinds of things with your family, because the more stuff you get involved in like that, you can't practice. And what is it that's actually going to be of most value to you at the end of your life? It's the Dharma practice, you know, because, you know, they can make money and send it to their family, and it's an act of charity, but it's also charity done out of attachment, isn't it? Because it's attachment to one's own family. And they're forsaking the ability, you know, to do the Dharma study and do their Dharma practice and to do retreats and to do things that purify their mind that will enable them to have a good rebirth and progress on the path to liberation and enlightenment. So they're giving up that higher happiness and that higher good that goes for all sentient beings in order to help a few people and their family this life. Yeah. So that's why, you know, it's confusing because we hear about benefit sentient beings and then people get in their mind, oh yes, you know, a monastic goes and gets a job and sends money to their family and that's a good way. Well, no, you know, not when they can really practice the Dharma and have the opportunity to get advanced spiritually. Okay, so it says, though obtaining the precious human rebirth, I seek the hell realms. So such a person like this, you know, has a precious human life with all the good circumstances, but then they wind up in hell. I mean, of course, nobody deliberately seeks the hell realms, okay? Although you could seek Hollywood, I guess. That's a form of hell realm. You think it's a God realm, but it's actually hell. But another way to translate this line is, I wind up in hell. And why do people who you know, do all these things wind up in hell? Well, it's because they haven't, you know, they're so busy doing other things that there's no time to do purification practice. There's no time to check their mind. There's no time to develop a good motivation. And also, in doing all these things, like to get money and do business, people can create a ton of negative karma. you know, through lying, through harsh words, through divisive speech, because you get involved in all the politics in your office, you know, through cheating on your income tax, through taking things that aren't given. There's so many different ways of creating negative karma. And so, you know, that person is deliberately putting themselves into a situation where they can create a lot of negative karma, but in their mind, they're explaining it to themselves as, oh, I'm doing something good for my family, or I'm doing something good for the Dharma Center, or whatever it is. But it's pretty difficult, you know. Some people can pull it off, and I admire them, but for most of us who have uncontrolled minds, doing that is really rather dangerous. Okay, so this verse doesn't just pertain to monastics, it also pertains to anybody who gives up Dharma study and practice for worldly pleasure, for, you know, earning as much money as they can, for having possessions, for having a comfortable life. And so this, you know, it happens to lay people as well, so don't think you can get off the line. Get off the hook on this line, you know. But, you know, we just give up the opportunity to practice because we want pleasure and, you know, to do other stuff. And it's really a pity because when we meditate, you know, quite a bit extensively on the qualities of the precious human life, and on the purpose and meaning of a precious human life, and on the difficulty of attaining one, then, you know, boy, we realize how incredibly fortunate we are and how difficult it is to have the kind of life and opportunities we have, you know. And so when we really understand precious human life and we get a feeling of what it means to be born again and again in cyclic existence and how fearful that actually is, you know, then we realize, wow, I have a life where I have the possibility of counteracting that. You know, then we don't want to waste our life, you know, just seeking for temporary pleasure at all, because what's the purpose? You know, there's no purpose, there's no benefit from that. And so our direction in life really changes. So, you know, that's why meditation on precious human life comes at the beginning of Long Rim, because, you know, we, of course, to meditate effectively on precious human life, we have to have some understanding of what it means to be born in samsara. And when we understand that, we understand how suffering it is in nature, you know, the three kinds of suffering. And then we see this life gives us the possibility to get out of it. It's like, wow, I don't want to waste my time on the eight worldly concerns, which is basically what we spend most of our day doing. It's like, hey, I don't want to do that. That's a waste of time. That's stupid. It's boring. It doesn't give me any happiness at all. You know, I really want to put my life into purifying my mind, transforming my mind, you know, cultivating the heart of love and compassion and acting in that way towards other beings. And so we reset our priorities, you know, and when we do that, then we don't wind up in the hell realms. Okay? So why do we get involved? Again, these verses are all about distraction, aren't they? You know, they're all about having the opportunity to practice, these verses that we did today. They're all about having the opportunity to practice, but the mind thinking that something else is more valuable. Mm-hmm. And so getting distracted from doing our practice by thinking either that New Age this and that is more valuable, or that therapy will lead us to enlightenment, or that we should earn money, you know, to give to our family, or that we really want a comfortable life, or, you know, somehow doing something that distracts us from transforming our mind. And, you know, when we see this in other people and when we see it in ourselves, this is not something to get judgmental about. It's something to have compassion about, you know. So not to criticize other people, not to criticize ourselves. Have compassion for ourselves, have compassion for other people, and criticize the self-centered thought that makes us and them do this. Because it's the self-centered thought that deserves to be criticized. Because that's the one that is, you know, depriving us from the opportunity of enlightenment and liberation. Yeah. But don't criticize or judge the person, because the person's under the influence of the self-centered thought, under the influence of the affliction. Yeah. Okay. So compassion's really important in that kind of context. Yeah. Compassion and a resolve when we see our mistakes to do something different in the future. So we don't get stuck in blaming others or blaming ourselves and feeling guilty, you know. We look at our mistakes, we recognize them, we regret them, but we don't stay stuck in our guilt, but we just make strong determinations for the future and we do some purification practice, and then we revamp our life and live our life in a different way in the future.